Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Deep Thoughts. It was a very early, cool morning in what we're going to call early winter of Southern California. I just worked the entire evening until morning. So this is my my dinner, my relaxation here. Today, I want to bring to you guys a little gem that one of the guys I spoke with just happened to say. He wasn't trying to make a big point. I don't think he was even choosing his words carefully or anything. He was giving a description, I think, in his language and bringing it to English. And the way he said it was beautiful. He mentioned the people before you. And then he made a point that we're going to make this whole episode about. Because I don't know about you, but I never really thought about it so simple. Why do I think a lot of the things that I think? Because of the people before me. Why do I believe history and other paradigms of existence? Because of the people before me. How are we utterly controlled in this world? How is that even possible? Because of the people before us, right? Now, you might think that that's like splitting a little bit of hairs and just instead of just saying history or the past, I think saying people before you is so much more powerful because it gives you a pinpoint of accountability in the equation of history. Right? If I say history, well, then it's everything. It's a freaking butterfly in Peru. It's the price of tea in China. It's how, you know, humid it was in Madagascar, you know. But if you say, no, wait. There's things that you can blame on nature, and that are nature's thing, nature's cycle. And then there's the intent of people before us, or the lack of attention of the people before us, which then leaves us in either a advantage or disadvantage moment, perhaps in some rare cases, benign moments, right? I forgot what we were watching. So I think in this episode, I'm going to run backwards. We're going to look at a bunch of different things and sort of assess the pros and cons of the people before us, give some credit where credit's due, maybe exonerate a few. And then I think we need to bring the whole thing back to now. And as we look in the mirror, as Michael Jackson would say, or contemplate who we are going to be on a daily basis and what we're willing to sacrifice for ourselves, for our families, for our friends and others, humanity, if you can so much as muster up the empathy to acknowledge such a thing, which you're a part of, let's see where we can go. I'm trying to think about how far to go back. Should I crawl from now to ancient times? Or should we start at ancient times, which is barely any definition at all, right? Let's talk about the positive first. And again, this episode is going to be first a broad stroke brush to open up your mind to see this cycle. And then hopefully a fine toothbrush that comes through and starts to put some details in, right? There's seven wonders of the world. At least that's what I was brought up with. Seven places on Earth, of which I believe man has to participate in its creation. And I think what's absolutely fascinating is one of the oldest, if probably, you know, again, there's a bunch of weird dates for things, but in, I think, Graham Hancock's research and our own sort of epiphanies of recent research, the Egyptian pyramids are the oldest amazing thing that we really definitively know about, right? We find temples and other locations, like, again, Stonehenge, which was moved in 1954. And so we're not sure. We're not sure where these people came from. I think it's hilarious that people want to think that Stonehenge has to be older than the pyramids, simply because it's more primitive. Because people in, white people in England were definitely smarter than the black people of Africa. No, no, I think we might have been the last one to join the race, okay? But now it's not what I'm getting into, so let's not get carried away. I don't know about you, but the pyramids are one of the most awe-inspiring, inquisitive things to have ever existed on this planet. I used to think that the older I got and the more I'd understand about engineering, you know, just, you know, I'm not getting a degree in it, but I mean, just hearing people talk about it, oh, someone's going to figure this thing out. The truth of the matter is, it's more of a mystery today, and we know more about them today than ever before in history. Yeah, well, for a long time it was all buried, but here we have things pretty excavated. Obviously, you can't talk to the Museum of Cairo unless you want to get a bunch of cartoon characters putting it together, but they're based on pie. They're made out of four corners to create a pyramid, so it wasn't all just made up as one big thing. The Great Pyramid has slanted stones in its interior. It's electric. It's got conductive stone and non-conductive stone. It's got circuitry made out of red granite inside. How they even suspended this stuff in the pyramid such that one block didn't just kind of jinga, you know, and crush somebody. You know, you got a bunch of the stuff at diagonal angles. Nope, stays together. It's been around for a really long time. Even official news puts it at 5,000 years old, over 5,000 years old. Amazing. Probably goes back 50 or more. At least 39. But those were some people before us. And of course, I'm neglecting all the other great structures, which you can listen to in any YouTube video. I did one called Monolithic Structures. Those pyramids, for me, represent this mind-opening thing. Once I stopped believing they were tombs, but even if I thought they were tombs and got into the most elaborate tombs ever made, which they're absolutely anything but a tomb, it still says, wow, here I am with all this technology. I've got a cell phone over there sitting on the table that's got more computer power, you know, a million times more computer power than anything in 1979 or 80, right? And I can't figure out how those pyramids were made. We have 7.5 billion people on Earth. No one who has existed to date has figured those things out. I mean, not even the most basic methodology of how to stack 2.3 million stones into one pyramid. People before us. Wow. Now, why aren't those people here to tell us how they did it? Right? I mean, the Egyptian Museum of Cairo, the very last race to actually participate in that area, wants you to think that they made them, but they didn't. Those people that made that place are long gone. Okay? They never documented how they ever built the place. But the reason why they're not there is because of other people before them, right? People who were into conquest, right? In the history of our ancestors, we will always have a group of people that invent a utopia. Now, it's going to take a long time to do it again. But eventually, we will get this place to utopia. And if we can do it with technology, then the cool thing is we could probably maintain it as long as we can, again, get rid of the DNA that's going to screw the place up. But in the past, it was all regional. There's a place that had utopia and a bunch of places that sucked. And of course, the people that couldn't figure it out ran in with sticks and stones and whatever the hell they had figured out and took over the better places. And then, of course, they didn't have the sophistication or the intelligence to maintain it, so it starts to wane. The only things that exist are the things that can't be torn down. It was, you know, you might not know how to take care of a pyramid or a temple, but you can't just tear the thing down. There's no point in tearing it down. Although, they do say that all the stones were looted off the outer coating of the pyramids, right? As indicated by one of the capstones, right? If those things were batteries, then the number one thing you'd have to do to make sure that no one knows that they're batteries is to take off all that external stone. But even that would be a feat, wouldn't it? They used to say that when I was a kid that those outer stones were taken so that by looters that wanted to use the stone for something else. I don't know how many people could use slanted stone because it was outer stones were all cut, right? But they were looted. Strange. I just love the subject. I'm sorry, I'm digressing. The next thing I want to get to is the paradigm of war. The paradigm of taking someone else's stuff. Now, the idea is that, you know, if you want to go into a forest, right? When you look at Deadwood, the history of Deadwood, South Dakota, I think it's South Dakota. It's a valley. It's underdeveloped. It's got, you know, tons of trees. And these settlers want to go in there and mine all the gold. They do a bunch of gold prospecting. And so they got in there and they clear cut the place with their bare fucking hands and got the place situated. Well, now, what if they had the option of a place that's already lived in? That has the same, you know, inspirational gold mother loads. Well, they would have gone there instead, right? So, wars happen for a billion reasons. Over the course of a couple thousand years, the leadership discovered, well, Jesus, you know what? You know when the people, you know what saved my ass from getting, you know, lynched by the people when I couldn't feed them and all this other stuff? That war I had with you. Man, they just stopped focusing on their problems that I was creating for them because I was eating all their food myself. And so I think that should be the way we do this every once in a while. You pretend to hate me, I'll pretend to hate you. You know, we'll sneak out into that Bohemian Grove every once in a while and do each other. War came after the last utopia, which was the Egyptian rule of northern Egypt. I mean, if you look at the whole spectrum of the planet, it's a teeny tiny area on the planet. It's bigger than Rhode Island, but I think it's smaller than California, right? And they had managed to just absolutely master technology. And if our hunches are correct about their electricity and things like that, then they were ahead of Tesla. But what happened when war, and I did a whole episode on war, so I'm not going to try to repeat myself, but what happened when war became an acceptable means for people to solve their problems? Isn't it funny that people will be lazy about information? And this is going to be singing to the choir just a bit, but let me put this little quiver, this little, excuse me, arrow in your quiver. People deny the truth all the time, right? They deny that evil people are evil, that foundations steal money and traffic kids and all this other stuff, right? Because it hurts our little feelings. But the end result of that denial going day in and day out and year in and year out is that eventually you're sold a war to solve the problem in a lot of cases, right? Now, obviously, in an absolute sense, my example is not very accurate. But something is communicated to us that we could respond to, and we don't respond to it. And so it grows and it festers. The propaganda to make us hate someone else grows and festers, right? So you have maybe an injustice going on in a particular type, particular place in the world, and then you are sold the disinformation through all of your, you know, corporate media, everything, sitcoms, movies, fucking everything, right? It makes you want to go over and kick their ass, or at least support someone who has been given the job to do so. But then your kid grows up, becomes a big badass, right? And they enlist in the military, and that you're very proud of that, and they're very happy to be there. But then they get sent to one of these wars, and that's when, as a parent, you go, ooh, wait a minute, that's way more real than this yell at the TV that we should go nuke them, and my kid's going over there. Is my kid really ready for war? I mean, most parents should ask that question at one point. Am I able to see death and still maintain, you know, functional infantry training? You know, is it possible, right? Hopefully the answer is yes. How many wars have we been in that now we find out through revised history that the people before us created the war out of absolutely nothing, financed the war, said that the good guys were bad and the bad guys were good, and damn it, if some of those wars you didn't find out, you belong to the wrong side. Again, the internet's causing some problems for the people trying to hang on to some of this narrative. And a lot of you comment in the comment section, and I don't put my shit out there, but we're on the same page, okay? I am at a minimum throwing up everything that I thought was one way and considering the possibility strongly that it might have been the other way. But let's just look at some wars that are very simple to say they were bullshit. The North Korean police operation, right? It's not a war, it's a police operation. Complete fucking bullshit. Selling you that those dumbed down nomenclature so that it feels like it's something, oh, we're just over there for, you know, a police thing. Well, go ask everybody who died over there or got injured over there from our side. Completely pointless. And what is ironic and amazing and unbelievable is that they sold them another war. Not more than, was it 1954? That was over, so you start one. About 9 years later, in 1963, two fake Gulf of Tonkin events. They start another one of those wars in Vietnam, and this shit lasts for, about 12 years? Killed the crap out of all kinds of people, our side, their side. And now every time you meet a Vietnamese person, personally, you're embarrassed, right? It's like, I'm really sorry, man. That I wasn't really alive at the time that was going on, or I was a little child. Okay, you think we learned a lesson, right? But now, why do we join some of these organizations? Because of the people before us. Did, you know? Now, again, I would have loved to have served my country. I was a geek instead and moved to California and got a dream career going. Plus, when I was moving out here, there was nothing going on. 1987, there's no major war effort. A bunch of my friends who were in Desert Storm were in it for 48 hours and then they were out. It's a pretty peaceful time. How many people are, you know, they have a tradition in their family? They're all police officers, they're all this, they're all that. It's very interesting, and it's can be a really, really cool thing. You pass down all the secrets, right? Al Unser Jr., you know, I mean, it happens. But the main thrust of people before you is propaganda, disinformation. Now, for everybody who was raised by a parent that wasn't raised with the internet as a part of their life, we have to give them a little bit of a reprieve. Because the information that they got was through extremely formalized and super controlled yellow journalism, very intensely controlled publishing companies that report to, you know, them. Go see my episode on them if you have any questions. So my parents, there's no way for them to really wake up at this point. It's impossible. One, they had a completely picture-perfect life. I mean, in terms of what America said, the American dream was, it was 100% on target. Which means the variables, you know, didn't get everything you wanted, but damn near, right? But as I've said before, you know, if you're raised a mutt, your life is a little bit weird. Your parents got divorced. That's your first qualification of being a mutt. Then you moved around a lot instead of actually staying in the same place. That'll make you even more of a mutt. And if you manage to become successful, that makes you a super mutt. Because you're crafty, right? You're street smart. You're enlightened because you can see more. If you couldn't see more, you wouldn't be successful. But today, everyone should be woke who grew up with the internet. I'd say everyone born probably from 1980 and up Anyone 1990 and up? Hell yes. And 2000 and up, you guys have no excuse for being an Antifa douchebag. You know, you should be absolutely a mercenary for the Republic. But why do we keep up really shitty activities? You know, you've got this thing between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and you guys always want me to talk about the Jews and how bad they are and stuff. I am going to do an episode about Judaism and Zionism, the difference between the population that is almost 80% atheist and the Zionists that are completely different species of human being. I don't mean that literally, but you know what I'm saying. But they fight. They've been fighting for a really long time. It got really intense after the League of Nations made Israel a country. It got really intense. But there's all kinds of places around the world that are doing that. Yemen, one of the places, it's probably one of the most poverty-stricken countries. I don't mean to laugh, but it's like, the second thing I'm going to say is one of the richest countries in the world, Saudi Arabia, is always attacking the shit out of them. What's all that about, right? Pakistan and India, they bicker a lot. Why? For us, you could stand a Pakistani guy in front of me and an Indian guy in front of me, and I probably couldn't tell you which country they're from, but they fight like they're, you know, humans against the Zindis, you know, I don't know. Africa. Oh my God. How many dualities, genocidal dualities, exist in Africa currently? It's insane. Absolutely insane. But how did all that come about? And why and how could anyone rationalize these senseless bickering moments between two groups? I think it's because of the people before us. Handing down this hatred. You know, you got to hate them. You're chosen. They're not. Even though you're almost exactly the same. You got the same bloodline. Here. So you got to kill them. Whatever you got to do. Yeah, you know, some guy gets shot in his last dying breath. You waste your whole life. Waste your whole life for me. You know, hating them over there. I think what's interesting and horrible and fascinating, to repeat myself, is that one of the races on this planet, they got the most taken out of them, and probably Aborigines are a close second, is the Native Americans. Now, we're told a lot of things about them, obviously, being savages and all this. The truth of the matter is, we now have seen that in so many scripts. We know how the game is played. You want to get rid of somebody? We'll start calling them a name. Start reprogramming the minds of people before they get to move over there. Indoctrinate them to saying, this is your land. These guys aren't supposed to be here. When they were the indigenous race, right? I'll leave that in. See, I just wave my arms. The crow sees me through the lattice above me. And he flies off because he thinks I'm a big-ass bird. A little trick for you guys. Now, the Native Americans are obviously not happy with the situation. But in my lifetime, and in the history that I have digested, which is probably a tiny molecule of all the history, I've never heard of an uprising of Native Americans. When I've gone to reservations, unfortunately, I've seen a broken people. And it makes me concerned that they're broken and continue to be broken. Now, again, I'm not saying the whole race is broken, and you couldn't make me happier than to have a repopulation of their incredibly unique race. I mean, their genes are just amazing, right? I mean, I grew up in a Native American world in Kansas, where my best friend's whole family was Native American, and I just thought this is what it was. I thought it was cowboys and Indians, but we all kind of settled our war, so we're just all hanging out together, you know? And then I moved away, and I was like, are there no Native Americans anywhere else? Like, everything's named after them, right? But I fear that they've been indoctrinated into giving up, right? Some of the saddest things you can ever read, saddest letters you can ever read, are from the Native American chiefs that had to deal with the pounding from the white man. The humble nature of their letters, and, you know, they were quoted as saying, you know, look, it appears the gods want the white man to win. Or else, why would he give him the ships and these guns and these technology to just wipe us off the map? I don't know that I would ever write that letter. I don't know that I'm big enough as an intellectual person to say that, right? They did, often. The gist of this episode, if it's not becoming very apparent here, is how much of who you are today is a direct byproduct, aka transfer of someone else's knowledge and opinions directly into you. I mean, you know, we have these little sayings, you know, the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree. Meaning you're like your parents. And, you know, in one realm, if you're able to live with your parents and have an extremely close relationship with your parents, that might be the most beautiful thing and the best compliment in the world, because your parents are amazing people. And I hope that for every single one of you. For me, my parents were all into themselves. And so as soon as they had me, they're like, man, we're not fucking doing that again. Jesus Christ. That cut into my personal time, right? And then when they divorced, when I was about 9 years old, I was just like, all right, I get rid of this layer of micromanagement. I get to fucking do what I want. This is great. And so the more I crawled into books and technology and arts and all that kind of stuff, man, they were thrilled to death. He just totally takes care of himself. Oh my God, we can do whatever we want. So I never had this huge connection with either one of my parents. I love them, but I don't have, if you have a really close relationship with your parents, you got something I've never had, right? The reason I mention that is that I think a lot of this practice of the people before us, I got out of external sources, right? Because I didn't have a big internal source except my grandparents and some of my aunts and uncles. But now let me ask you, does every single person who existed before you, who you might meet after you're born, do they all inspire you? You take all the advice from everyone that you ever meet? Hell no, right? You wait for something that sounds smart. You wait for an example of a human being that has something that you want, probably. Well, you know, up until Donald Trump becoming president, a lot of folks bought his books, attended his lectures, and had no problem with the guy. And after he became president, you know, they got all this, oh, what party am I? I can't think for myself. Okay, yes, we hate him. Okay, why do we hate him? Oh, he's a racist. Okay, how is he racist? We don't care. There's no facts about that. Okay, sure. Right? This is so new to me that as I make this episode, I'm really just surveying my own mind as to some of the highlights and the archetypal highlights of things where I there was an attempt to shut my mind off and I fought back, you know. I'm trying to think of ones where I was completely indoctrinated, you know, and I think that a lot of the official stories that were told as young kids, you know, we went to the moon, the Harvey Oswald shot JFK, that sort of thing. 9/11 was totally Osama bin Laden, da-da-da. I bought it all hook, line, and sinker for a while. Where I was actually being fairly progressive was that I was inspired by folks that I would later become very good friends with as I watched films as a young kid. And, you know, I fell in love with Sid Mead. Like I've said, I did a whole episode on him in season 3. I think it's the last episode. I grew up with his stuff on TV and the movies, and he just drew things differently, but he drew them in a way you could understand them. And so you're looking at it going, well, okay, I understand exactly what he did as the finished product, but how did he get here? I'm not quite sure. But let's look at this. Man, this is weird. That's just sort of that, okay, yeah, sure. Right? And it gets your brain thinking differently. There's shapes in this world that children have a hard time conceiving of until you give them a second to really digest it, right? Isn't a tetrahedron the 20-sided die? There's all kinds of crazy you know, symmetrical shapes and asymmetrical shapes. You craft it and you give it to a baby to look at when they can start holding stuff. And they're going to start looking at this thing going, what is this thing? And their brain is trying to conceive of all the crevices and how the polygons all connect together. It's extremely healthy for the brain, right? Well, Sid was that for me, starting with the movie Tron, 1982, right? I always felt like I could feel good design. Like it's some part of my genes. You know, I saw something beautiful, I just felt it. You know, one thing felt better than the other. But when I started crossing over into academic science is when I really started to feel what this guy was talking about, this these people before me. And it was very interesting, and I've mentioned this once before, when I was in physics class, my thing was that I had already studied probably, I got into physics, I think, in my senior year, yeah, and because I take all these prerequisites and all this other crap. But so I would have been 16 years old, so I would have probably had a good 7 years of physics before I got into high school. And, you know, my teacher's complaint was that he'd mentioned something and I'd mentioned the textbook paragraph just off the top of my head. And it cut down on a lot of the mental exploration of the other students, right? Because I'd give the answer. And then everyone else was like, okay, yeah, what he said, right? But so I had 6 years to think about some of these theories before they were being taught to me in class. And one of the things that was extremely frustrating to me was that they were saying that, you know, nothing could go the speed of light. Because according to E equals mc squared, the whole universe has to push one particle. But the particle's missing from the push, and it would need itself to push itself, and this absurd goddamn theory. Because you're sitting there thinking, well, light goes the speed of light, right? And of course they didn't teach us that Tesla and Faraday had tracked it at, you know, 50 times the speed of light. Like 100 years before I'm being taught this, it was completely figured out. So my teacher puts it on the board and he boils down through the formula of exactly what this meant and some of the ramifications. And then he says the line that we can't go the speed of light because of this formula. And I'm sitting there staring at chalk that's been rubbed off on black slate. And that is inspiring my teacher to come up with this people before him theory that says, well, we don't need to go down this route anymore because it's been completely figured out. We can't do this. Can't. Well, what's interesting was 7 years earlier, as I was cracking open the World Encyclopedia, looking at my first fission class, my teacher, who was my, I only had really one art teacher that was a private guy who was hired outside my school. And he, if you ever said can't, he stopped you from your project, which was usually painting in oils, and he would pull you out and sit you down and give you a pencil. And he'd say, you know, make your hand like this, you know, where you can see all the gross parts. And he goes, draw that. And you can't go back to your painting until you've finished this hand. One guy did it. One guy actually said he can't, and he had to draw it, and he whined and moaned, but then he drew a perfectly wonderful hand, and he was like, oh, shit, I guess I can, and so he goes back to his painting, and it, I can't remember what he painted, but my teacher had two deformed hands, so on his right hand, he only had his index finger and his thumb, and on his left hand, all of his fingers were very interesting. They were just very kind of bubbly shapes, but nothing. He could pinch things with it, but he couldn't really do stuff. He's right-handed anyway, so he just grabs the brush and painted this beautiful safari stuff. I mean, the guy, there's nothing this guy can't paint. Mr. Dolliff. His slogan was, art is my game. He's still alive. He's in Derby, Kansas, I believe. Super dude. I'd love to hang out with him. So he was breaking my mind of saying, okay, you think you can't? Stop saying that. You know, no one ever discovered anything because they started off their day with, well, let's see what we can't do and let's can't do it some more, right? Mm-mm. One of the things we don't want to allow is the people before us to shape our minds before we've had a chance to figure out what shape we would have made it in the first place, right? I never thought about it when I was a child, but obviously at this later stage of 2018, I think the internet has proven through mass communication that racism, will save like some really interpersonal problem that might have happened, and then you blame the person's genetics for their behavior, right? Racism is probably a completely taught paradigm of existence. It destroys the world. It's responsible for a lot of the things I've already mentioned today, right? It would be interesting to raise a child, not outside of the confines of safety and good common sense, but when it came to things like science, and perhaps the arts, and perhaps sociology and how we look at each other, instead of saying, well, you can't do that, you can't, you just simply say, well, we haven't figured out how to do that yet. There's some people who think that we can't, and they worship a religion called science with a capital S, and it gives them comfort. They go on to YouTube channels and post feverishly about how they're right and how you're wrong, so they can feel better about themselves and sleep at night. But they don't really know either. There's a lot of people who believe that there's a magic guy that came down from the sky and had a virgin birth 26 times and 26 different names and 26 different places on earth, 26 different times in history. But the last guy that came was the one that most people remember on this planet. You know, when you ask me what year it is, well, that's the year when they rumored him to have died. And that makes it more real for them. Now, maybe he did come down 26 times, and this is something that just needs to happen. Or maybe it's just an old story that provides a lot of control for one group of people to control another group of people. And it's handed down by the people before us. Haven't you ever gone to bed at night? You're laying on your pillow, and you have this habitual thought, and it could be anything, right? I'm not even sure I'm going to give you an example. It's something in your behavior. Maybe you're sensitive about something and you wish you weren't sensitive about it, or maybe you're just lazy. Maybe you're really not lazy compared to most people, but you'd wish you were more focused. You know, you watch a Steve Jobs. This is one that kills me. I never, you know, walked into Steve's office every single day to, you know, see how he did his thing. But man, the guy was productive. I mean, just everywhere all the time. Work, 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 work. And maybe he was a little bit on level 11, and maybe he needed to be on like level 7 or 8 to have a really healthy family. I don't know. But you just want a little bit of that, right? Like, you're thinking, geez, if I could just go to bed tonight and the operating system that is me in this mortal coil, you know, my soul is probably perfect and it can concentrate all day long. But the mortal coil, for whatever reason, the way I'm feeding myself, the way I'm getting good rest or not good rest, it's allowing me to be less than what I want. And you just think, well, I just want to go to bed and get an update. Just the auto install, man. Just upgrade that little piece of my software. So tomorrow, I can make it happen. Well, now, rewind for a second and ask yourself, why do you think you have those issues in the first place? Sometimes kids are lazy because their parents are lazy. Sometimes they're lazy because their parents are absolutely overachievers. And it just seems awful. They don't get a chance to talk to their parents much because their parents work too much. And so their counter move is to go, man, I don't want to be like those folks. Yeah, I'm not sure what I want to be, but I don't want to be one of those folks. Sometimes you find your love in life, and then you start to shut out the voices. You start to shut out anyone who is indoctrinating you because you're in total control. You have everything that you need to be absolutely elated every single minute of the day, for the most part, for at least giant stretches in your life, years and years of your life, right? I think as a human being, we should want that for all of the fellow human beings as well as ourselves, right? And even if you can't get it yourself at this particular time in your life, but you can give it to somebody else, right? You can refer a friend to a friend. A couple things happen, right? One, you take one more human off the list of being unhappy and lazy. Two, if they're your friend and they're going to go a place where you'd like to be, right? Well, maybe they'll come back and send you a postcard to come visit them, and they can get you in after they get in. Maybe they're better than you currently at what you're trying to do, and so it's going to give you an in, and it's going to give you some time to perfect what you do, right? By the way, I just want to say they are chemtrailing the shit out of Orange County in November of 2018. If there's any type of big giant super fire in Southern California, I just want you to remember this fact. One of the things that I think about when I think about this people before us thing, before I was ever put into words, was that my parents and people of their age validate certain media types to be absolutely pure and without error. Magazines of a certain caliber, right? If it's got a posh name like the New Yorker, posh cartoons that the average Joe doesn't get, you know, a bunch of inside references or what have you within a cartoon, they feel better than someone else, which is really important for these people, these weak-minded folks. But anything that's bound in a hardback book for centuries, the idea was that a publisher would do its due diligence and take your book and have it vetted by everyone on the planet they can get that's an expert in what you're writing about. You know, even a fictional book, it's vetted for its story quality, its grammar, all that kind of stuff. So by the time it gets to you, it is sort of a tome of all knowledge. And so if you hear something from someone who was actually at a particular place in time, and you just get free information directly from the source, right? When you talk to these old school folks, they immediately poo-poo eyewitnesses. Because in their mind, they're going to keep their mind open until Reuters AP, same company owned by the Rothschilds, reports in to tell you what really happened. They're going to turn on their favorite television channel, watching their favorite personality, who's been a fucking repeater for 50, 60 years, right? These folks that pretend to be journalists, like they'll say, well, I'm a journalist. Oh, really, Peter Jennings? When's the last time you got out there in the field and saw something with your own eyes and then wrote it down? And supposedly your eyes are better than my neighbor's eyes, right? You could have a guy that watches a building fall, free fall. It's 110 stories. It's completely an impossibility. At the bottom, there's almost no debris because the entire building atomized into a pyroclastic cloud. But a guy from CNN will see it and tell you what happened. But your buddy, who's got maybe two or three PhDs in those realms, from metallurgy to structural architecture, they will have been there, have seen it happen with their own eyes, and then come back to you and go, well, that's impossible. Then you report that up with a very valid resource, right? And they'll tell you that those resources that you know are fruitless because the organization that would be otherwise accused of creating the event told you that they weren't at fault, that it was someone else's fault, right? We got a guy roaming around the comments right now who is so lost in that particular day when that happened. He is either a big fucking shill who's running around trying to change everyone's mind, posting just links into like the most official news crap you've ever seen in your life. But he is, if he's not a shill, he's one of these guys. He's one of these guys who is like, I am a coward. I will not look at the truth because that means I got to fucking get off my lazy ass and put some skin in the game, right? He is totally hugging the little doll of those people that came before him, right? Now, you've guys heard me say this a lot recently, but when I was debriefed, informally, of course, by two acquaintances that worked for NASA, who had recently resigned within the last 3 years, both of them, different times, but within the last 3 years, both of them got out, both of them extremely brilliant. I think one of them had a PhD, now that I think back about it, because I remember we had a room full of PhD people. It's really funny. But here I am getting debriefed from the source. Right, not guys that participated in 1969 through 72. No, they were kids too, but They were watching that shit on TV, trust me. But these folks were on the inside looking for just the official stuff. Hey, just give me the official schematics and I'll go and help the Mars Project build a new platform to get further and deeper into space. Kept looking, couldn't find anything. Finally pulled aside, told. One of them was really pulled aside. The other one I don't think was pulled aside. But they both quit because they realized their jobs were going to be pointless. They were going to have to move because the base that they were on, the NASA base they were on, was being shut down, as I remembered. So, you know, it was reason to question their career. But when it was like, geez, I'm not going to be really doing anything in my lifetime, fuck this, man. I'm going to go do something. And one of them, one I don't remember, I lost track of him almost immediately. We worked together for a year after that. But the other one I worked for another year with, he went off and made gobs of bucks because of his brain cells, okay? But I will sit with the baby boomer and try to share that information. And when I hear them talk, and I know you've had this happen, right? When I hear them talk, I hear the words coming out of their mouth, and they are repeating something that they heard from mass media. Almost 95% of what they say is just sound bites from mass media, and they actually think that they're forming their own thought in their mind, but they're not having an original thought at all, right? I'm not sure they can, which is interesting, right? Well, they think they can. Oh my God, they think they're absolute world experts on everything. They have a good memory for repeating. Again, they're smart, but not intelligent. They don't deduce anything. They don't invent anything. They just repeat. And what's interesting about those people is that they typically have very low self-esteem and very low self-confidence, even though they are trying to portray the antithesis of that in public. Oh, no, no, no. I know I'm very smart. Just watch me show you, right? History, we now know, I believe we can now say we know, is so convoluted and so revised that unless we can crack open some building somewhere and find the fairly believable source, right? Something that maybe correlates with observed reality, where we can take a book from, you know, the Vatican's basement. It's probably got Alexander's library down there. And we can pull something out and they tell us where the real Jerusalem was and where Troy was and we can, or where Atlantis was, and we can just go there and we start seeing all the footprints on the bottom of the ocean or whatever. And unless that happens, mankind has been, well, put it this way, we haven't yet reached a point where our history is recorded properly, accurately. We have a fleeting moment right now, and I'm not sure humanity understands how absolutely powerful this moment is right now as of 2018. If QAnon is real, which Jesus Christ, that guy promises a lot of shit, but if he's real and we actually are able to conquer a big, big chunk of this evil, however that's done, okay? Death, punishment, incarceration, or all the above. And then we can eventually boil this up to the people so that we can stop repeating history. One of the ridiculous things that Q keeps saying is that, you know, a bunch of this will never be revealed to the public because it's too horrific. Really? Really? That's a movement for fucking justice and the American way? Anywhere on planet Earth? I think that's a complete line of bullshit, right? You know, unless you had a magic wand, which they don't, to get rid of these people, then we need to know. If there's a cartel of human traffickers sitting in the middle of your hometown, but they don't want to tell you that your kid could be kidnapped at any one moment by the Podesta brothers, they don't want to tell you because it might hurt your feelings. It might scare you at night, right? And so they're just letting you play the lottery with every single day of your life while they know exactly where everyone is and they never go in those locations. I don't know how humanity recaptures history. I've thought about making an episode on it, but I would need to deep dive into some of the areas of history that I find very fascinating and bring some case studies such that you're not bored to death. I think that I can say accurately, to some degree, and probably a lot of you have had this as well, you do focus and have focused for years on all the people before us. Some that are still alive and some, most, that are probably long since gone. When you find out that history has been revised at almost every single turn, and of course there's disinformation to make us believe these things so we don't trust anything. Believe me, they're hip to all the mind games because they wrote the book on it, okay? Probably quite literally. But as I've lived the last, again, probably 13 years, becoming woke at an extremely unhealthy rate. I mean, it really was an unhealthy rate of which I was digesting information, probably pulling down, you know, a bunch of disinfo at the same time, and I'm probably still full of some of it. Hopefully less and less each day. You start to lose your confidence in what you thought was the way the world worked. Who were the good guys? Who were the bad guys? Who were the good presidents of your country? Prime ministers, chancellors? Have you worshipped wars? Have you worshipped wars like me? Or revered wars, I should say, not worshipped them, but revered wars that you thought were absolutely legit. You were on the right side. Those people that died should have died. Your people should have died. You should have been in the war in the first place. And then you find out, oh my God, maybe this was the worst thing that we've done to date. It's a hell of a thing to reset, isn't it? It's a hell of a thing to have everything that you thought was legit subtracted from your consciousness, and then you're sort of left in this conscious void, and I mean conscious void, in that you're aware that the history that you were told was untrue. And we don't really cognitively, if you're like me, realize how much comfort we get from those moments. You know, when you're a kid, and this is something I meant to mention earlier in this equation of the people before us, but when you're a little tiny kid, you know, you could have the best childhood on planet Earth with really, really caring parents that are always there for you. If you're not, I mean, this gets even more intense exponentially, but you have to grab a hold of language, process, you know, this is how we eat, this is how we excrete, you know, I mean, it's everything you have to get from everyone. That's a touch. This is a no touch. This is what we call entertainment. This food is actually considered good. You're grappling at a rapid pace so that you can control your soul repenetrating into this particular reality. I mean, look at a baby that has to learn how to crawl. They're learning how to control this marionette that they're inside of. So it's no wonder we develop this conscious habit to grab paradigms, to find comfort. Once you get past the strategic basics of eating, sleeping, and what have you, as a kid, you then move on to usually sex and money. Sex because it's absolutely inbred in us to procreate. That's what we're supposed to be doing. Save this last probably 5 years with the 72 genders, 70 of which that won't procreate, right? Isn't it funny? Most of these genders are all about not procreating. What gender are you? Are you a procreator or non-procreator? Oh, so you're those other folks, you know? It's interesting. Why do you go for money? It's because you find out in some cases it contributes heavily to your ability to get the first thing, sex, right? Once you want either of those things, we no longer live in little tiny villages anymore in most places in the world. Some little towns in the Midwest and Europe are essentially the same qualifications. So you have a very limited scope of things. If no one thinks they're going to leave the town, they're going to have to pick from people inside. Then you just simply do boy-girl ratios and you go, hey man, there's more girls than boys. I guess I got something to pick from. But once you crawl inside that, what happens? The people before you get to control you like a mofo, right? And you don't notice it at first, do you? You're just mocking everything around you like a little kid, even though you might be 18, 22 years old. When you teach kids, I usually almost exclusively teach kids in college, you know, 18 and up. And my classes are usually the 18 to 22, you know, realm, but a lot of times there'll be a guy or girl who's coming in their 30s or 40s, changing their career. And it's very inspiring. Those people really, really inspire me because they've realized it's never too late. And that's the truth, man. It is never too late. You know, if you want to be a ballerina and you're 50, you may have to go to a local ballerina, you know, community center or something. But for the most part, people could find something that they love that they can get at their age, right? But these kids will have a level of insecurity that almost baffles you, right? I see these kids and I see the terror in their face. And a lot of the kids who come up to me after class will say, I need your help. And I'll say, why? Well, I love it here. I like the school. I like the opportunities, but I'm not sure which thing I want to do. I'm like, okay. And, you know, take all the self-improvement courses or lectures I put on this show. I go through the whole process of what makes you tick. Like, forget about this place. Forget about film and television and movies and all that kind of stuff. What makes you tick? Do you like helping people? Do you like creating things? What blows you away? Do you have a desire to blow other people away? Or do you want to be a spectator in the crowd? Maybe you're more of a critic than a creator, right? I haven't been stumped yet, you know. Sometimes, in order to get the solution, I refer them off to a professional, a former employee of mine or someone else who's doing what they are interested in, and they can go and see the whole ecosystem of the job, what it's like to get up in the morning and do that particular job, right? But now that I think about it, I think that the insecurities that they've had is that they've gone to the trough of the people before them too much, up to 18, up to 20, 20, 18, 19, 20, 22. Instead of building their own mind and thinking for themselves, they've been going the easy route, right? I love education so much, like being educated, that one, I wish I had two of me, so one could go off to school constantly and then bring all the information and jack it into the one that's actually doing the work, which is me. But it wasn't until I was probably in my early 30s that I met someone who said they had a college degree. And they were a waitress at this restaurant that I was helping to manage at night when I would go there to eat at night. I've mentioned this place a couple times, an Italian restaurant. This really sweet girl was working there. And she managed to mention, we're talking about raises and positions and stuff, and she's definitely one of the more, you know, tenacious waitresses at the time. She doesn't do this anymore at all. She's got a great career. But at the time, I think she was like 19, 20 years old, somewhere in there. And she said, she said she had a degree. And I go, what'd you get a degree in? She goes, psychology. I said, wow, really? Because, you know, I studied psychology like crazy, crazy, crazy. And I said, well, I guess you didn't go on to get your master's or anything else. What made you stop? And she said, well, I was a soccer player. And so I took psychology because it was rumored by the coach to be the easiest degree that you can get and maintain an academic prowess, right? I mean, an athletic prowess, excuse me. And right at that point, I should back up one second. We had another waitress, beautiful girl. I think she was 18. She'd just gotten a full scholarship to Pepperdine University. And I mean everything, the room, board, food, everything. She was, I guess, a really, really smart girl. And she left us fairly quickly. We had her first summer and that was it. Here she is, the polar opposite of the other one. Now, the other one was probably, she's less than 5 feet tall, so her becoming a professional soccer player was not in the game for her. I heard she was really good. So the long-term plan was not there. Get a degree that's simply an ancillary thing to be able to get the full ride through the soccer game, playing, right? Soccer scholarship. And the other girl is absolutely trying to become like a doctor. She's trying to become the best of the best. She does exactly what she wants to do, right? It was new to me that anyone would go to school just for the hell of it, you know, just to get the degree, because somebody says you have to. You know, I went to college for probably about 2.5 years if you combined all of my junior college stuff. That's about it. But I enjoyed every minute of it, save a couple weird teachers. But I still enjoy the classes, even though some of the teachers made tests that didn't match anything that they were assigning us to read or teach lecture-wise. And then they would complain that everyone's doing bad on the test. And I'm sitting there looking at the guy going, it's because you suck as a teacher? Pretty goddamn easy to tell a kid what's going to be on the test, right? I mean, subject-wise, right? But that even has a lesson unto itself, that sometimes you're going to have very formidable obstacles that are going to keep you from getting what you want, right? So how can we change our minds? Just in concluding this thing, how do we change our minds to gain more insight, more personal power, to quote Tony Robbins, right? I think, and I've said this in different ways in season one several times, which is I have this analogy I repeat every once in a while. I don't believe I've said it in season four yet, so let's do it. You have all these things that you have learned over the course of your life. Most things that you learn are in one of three piles in your brain. I don't know of a fourth. Please share one if you have a fourth. You got your truth pile, you got your false pile, and you have your maybe pile. I like to think of this as like a pantry, a big giant pantry in your house. And if any of you have seen those hoarding shows, what do they do with hoarding houses that are really bad? They take everything outside. They throw all the refuse away, all the dead cats and dogs, and then they clean up the whole house as best they possibly can, and then they make the person give up as much of the stuff on the yard as they possibly can, and then they put whatever's left back inside, hopefully more organized, right? I think as children, the more insecure we are, meaning either the less the we have less individuals providing valid information to us, right? You might have someone who's completely wrong all the time, giving you bad advice, and it always hurts you, and so you cut them off, but they're your main source, right? If you have a bad parent or bad guardian, you're like, Jesus, where can I get the information that works, right? But on a routine basis, we have to take everything out of the pantry. And you got your big giant shelves that are true, your false, and your maybe is kind of a table in the middle, like a big island in the middle of the pantry. It's important that anything that's significant to you in life, and I mean anything, the definition of love, the definition of the value of work, how to be a parent, how to be the best wife or husband or partner, whatever, super scientist, whatever, you have to take everything out and have the courage, well, the courage to do that, and have the courage to bring everything back in and reevaluate it with your current knowledge provided by the observable universe. Don't worry about the people before you. Use your brain. Don't worry about smarts, right? All that, you know, repeated crap that you memorize out of books. Make sure those things that you have read in books are out there on the pile. The rules by which you evaluate things is also the stuff that you have to evaluate constantly, which is why it's extremely important to become intelligent, because that is the part of your brain that will immediately engage when you have to evaluate something with your own mind, right? How many of you have done a massive change in your life from something you thought was extremely important, and later you just look back and you go, man, I don't know why I was like that. Why did I think that that was so important? It was so not important. In fact, maybe, you know, all of us are guilty of this. We missed out on part of our childhood, part of our decade of your life, your 20s, your 30s, your 40s, whatever, because you prioritize something too much. For a lot of guys, it's video games. You played too many games. And maybe if you can play games that make you a better person in reality, then in the end, it was worth it. So if you've ever divorced yourself from a particular behavior, then you have the mechanism in your mind to evaluate something. So maybe you did it for something less serious, and now you can do it for something serious. Or maybe you did it for something serious, and now you can do it for something less serious. But in the end, you begin to become the person that you want to be. And if you're uncertain about something, then great. You can go on a Dagobah Boon mission to find out the information that you think you need to make a better, intelligent evaluation of the things that are in the maybe pile that were previously on either the true pile or the false pile. Every single person I've ever met or ever heard about that ever defeated racism, indoctrinated racism from their youth, they've always said the same story. Well, my grandparents were really racist. My parents are really racist. And I grew up racist up to a point until I had an experience with someone of that race, and it was extremely pleasant, and I realized this was the most ridiculous thing I ever believed. Or these people were bad people because of the way their genetics were put together, how much pigment they have in their skin. Stupid, right? I mean, it's a great thing that we figured this stuff out. But somehow, in a lot of cases, we take those big, giant, broad-stroke, kind of no-duh moments, and we don't bring it back to a finer-tuned evaluation of everything else in our life. So let me give you another analogy that might help inspire you if you're still struggling. If I said to you, hey, you, I'm a very, very wealthy, eccentric person. I have set aside, I think, what I have allocated is an undeniable amount of money that will allow you to take your current home that you live in, let's say you have a home, and you can throw everything away that you want out of that house. Your TV, your beds, your nightstands, the light fixtures, the paint on the wall, the wallpaper on the wall, the paint on the outside of your house, whatever. You can throw it all away. And I will go in, and I will give you this big chunk of cash. And I will provide you with any resources that you need to get what you want, and you can completely redo that house. Floors, ceilings, everything. Even the clothes you put on your back could be completely different. I'll get you a full makeover. How exciting does that sound? Oh, wait a minute, there's a show. This is Move That Bus that used to exist. I don't know if it exists anymore. But that was so inspiring that we had, you know, how many like home makeover shows on TV at one point in time? I think there at one point in time was over a dozen. In fact, I just saw an article of one of the carpenters who's utterly famous from one of these little teeny tiny shows. Or I think he was probably making maybe a few thousand bucks per episode. And the guy's probably worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions. Why am I going on about this? Well, in this particular episode, that house is your brain. That house is all the circuitry that you have manifested and hooked together inside your mind to evaluate who you are as a human being. It's all the circuits that have made you who you are today. You know, they always say that you're a product of all your thoughts, right? I'm giving you the ability. I'm not trying to take credit for anything, but I'm just trying to say this conversation is about you having the ability to re-engineer who you are as a human being such that you can wake up tomorrow or 2 minutes from now and be a completely different person that's way more in line with who you feel that you are inside. A lot of times people get stuck in really bad ruts and they just are creatures of habit. I'm a creature of habit. I try to make really good habits, but I got my vices, of course. What would happen if you were able to get rid of like one of the little demons that was on your shelf in your pantry? That it's a habit that you had, but you didn't want to have it. But you couldn't figure out a way to get rid of it. Tony Robbins tries to teach you 1,000 different ways to demonize that thing that you hate, but that you do it anyway. And then he tries to take the vision of you at the end result of what you want to be, and he tries to take it from an apparition, a fleeting thought that just goes through your mind. You're like, oh, I just want that thing. I want to be that thing. And he says, no, grab it. Here's how you grab it. Boom. Now pull it really close. Now look at it. Don't look at anything else. Just look at the thing that you want to be and focus on it. What's the hottest commodity in 2018 in terms of mental commodities? It's, again, it's a thing that we all lust for nowadays, especially if you're watching this show. But now it's a thing that can be used against us, and it is being used against us as well. where the commodity is truth, with a capital T, which means the truth. If anything can be labeled with a capital T, it is, by its writer, considered to be an absolute. Why were you denied the capital T truth in any category of life? It's because of the people before us. Either through evil intent or absolute sheer ignorance. We're all ignorant of more things than we're probably smart about. But hopefully those things are irrelevant to our life and out of our circle of life, right? I am definitely ignorant about what 99% of the surface of this planet looks like, about the cultures that exist on those surface points. But I keep my circle, and the one that I travel in, I'm very well informed, I think. I don't know about you, but I'm pretty excited about this revelation to clarify my past that has inspired me down to individuals. And I think that it's important to think about it as people instead of this ambiguous gestalt that's out there, right? This big kind of vaporous apparition that is called history way too often. I think as well, it's also important for us to focus on the fact that we typically demonize people that are that have earned that label. They are evil people. And then we have our second, kind of a second tier down of people that are very complicit to being ill-informed. But maybe there's a bigger section of folks that have no association with those other two groups. They are not trying to be evil under any circumstance, right? Damn, keep it down up there, guys. The whole notion of the kind of rebuilding your house if you were a hoarder thing, and some people do it and they're not hoarders, is that you can't usually look at a huge chaotic mess, and unless you're autistic, you can't count it all. You can't get a grasp of the categories that things belong in. So a lot of people, when they live in dirty homes, they become very stressed out just by the vision of their home. Now, some people obviously feel very comfortable with that kind of stuff, and that blows my mind. But we don't have to know where all the negative influences are that are coming into us every single day if we have the courage and the capability of just for at least a little while cutting them all off and just simply saying, wait, you know what? I'm not going to listen to anyone else for a little while. I'm going to listen to me. And again, I have that little gut feeling of what is right and what is wrong. It's sort of a gift from the universe. You know, when you think of bad things, you feel bad. When you think of good things, you feel good, right? You know, you'll meet people that do self-destructive things, right? They have addictions, and they'll tell you, oh, I feel good when I'm on this drug, or I feel really good when I'm doing this very dangerous thing. But usually if you get them calmed down in the room, sobered up or whatever, and they really start reflecting on their life, they'll admit it. It's not good for them. And then they start to admit how they got addicted to it, the stages of addiction. And this isn't horrific drug taking or anything like that. I mean, it could be that, but it could just be real basic things. So let me give you a few things, and then I'll cut out of this video. A few categories that I personally find extremely important, for me personally, right? Maybe you agree. Time management is the most important thing in my life. What am I doing with every waking moment that I'm alive? I definitely consciously insert pastimes, things where I'm not actually doing anything super intense. I play a video game. It has no value. There's nothing I'm learning from the video game at my age that I need to be doing this. It's just completely stupid. But it's just inserted in the day to create a little bit of a low hum, you know, and I obviously play games that appeal to my instinct of being a human being. I've said it a couple times. I'll say it again because he's out there posting a lot on Instagram lately. But the reason why I own these microphones and that machine is because of a project I had with LL Cool J. His obsession is the word focus. And it's one thing to hear that, and you have to apply it in certain methodologies to make it actually have an instinctual value to you, right? Focus, in my opinion, is all about time management. Get up. Get out of bed. Don't sit in bed. Don't take a bunch of drugs that keep you in bed, right? Every single moment that you're alive, you could be creating something or doing something that is coming literally from your heart. And it will not feel like work because it is something that's from your heart. Again, I've said it in previous episodes, but if you have a job you don't like and you want to change jobs, well, probably the best thing to do is secure the one that you have, do really good at it so you're not on any target, and then go find the one that you want and take your time. Find a good employer. Find it close to your house. Make sure it's a good company. Look into their financials, you know? But you don't have to go that intense. Everyone in life has a to-do list that they need to take care of. You know, fortunately, if you live anywhere, those things get dirty, right? Homes get dirty. You got to clean them up all the time. It's a pain in the ass. Some of us don't have the natural instinct to just clean as they go through their house. Some people, my friends, I'll go over, we're having a 3-hour conversation, and the entire time I'm talking to them, they're sponging something down, wiping something down, drying something off. Their place is immaculate. A little bit of that freaks me out because I don't want to be that obsessive, but you know what I'm saying, right? I think about the word focus all the time now. Anytime you go through a transition, your routines are disturbed, and sometimes you'll go from being highly focused, highly productive, to like total confusion, chaos, a little disorientation. It takes a while. Sometimes it takes months. Sometimes it may take a couple years. But every day that you chip a little bit away at that obstacle, it eventually disappears or falls apart, and you get around it easily. And it becomes an innate skill that you're really good at. So you ever hit that obstacle again, it's like that one little coup de grace and it's gone, right? The other one is human interaction. Very, very important. I don't think anyone really likes being alone. I think sometimes life makes being with others rather difficult. At that point, you need to... Well, this is what I do. This is what I do. I try to pick friends that really enlighten me, bring something I haven't thought of before, or maybe I'm helping them. Usually it's the other way around. Usually they help me in one way or the other. They make me laugh, or they make me see a movie or a special or a documentary, or we have a conversation about something that I bring to you in a video, right? This whole video is based on one little conversation that happened. But the other one for me, in closing, really this time, is my deathbed analysis of my life. It's a hell of a thing to wake up in the middle of your life having been very proud of the things that you've done, but realizing on your deathbed, the evidence of your existence will be minimal at best. And so the way I have boiled that down is to simply say, if what I do doesn't make me a better person or make someone else a better person, like enriching someone else's life, passing the knowledge down, right? Then maybe I'm doing the wrong thing. And that means you can be totally selfish with the phase of your life because you're improving you, which then after you've done it, you can improve other people. But you have to pick your friends carefully. And that is something that I've covered in the friendship episode, which no one watches, but it's extremely important. I mean, I'm telling you, the amount of people that I have met personally that need to watch that episode is too numerous to keep track of. But every once in a while, you'll meet a very successful person, and you'll realize that they don't hang out with anyone who isn't enlightening. That brings them a very needed, deep-rooted laugh. It's very genuine. We inherit our friends from our walk of life, initially. You're stuffed into school after school after school. You have a neighborhood. You have family friends. And you hopefully love them, and you can keep them your whole life, and they're your crew. They're your rock, right? Sometimes you get a few stragglers in there, people who are really well-adjusted when they were younger, but not so much today. They're hanging on to old patterns, and you might need to cut them out for a little while. It might be that you cutting them out gives them the mother of invention to change their own life. I used to say this phrase all the time, it's a hell of a thing to be a man. But I definitely have been made more sensitive to the gender-specific orientation of that statement. I would say it's a hell of a thing to be a human being and really grow up. You know, a very close friend of mine said that one of the most courageous things you can ever do is get old and deal with the loss of your faculties over time. When you're used to them being there, and when they are your faculties, being able to see right, being able to walk around at will, because eventually we lose the mechanics of our body, don't we? I think a lot of us are on that pilgrimage to find the truth, to find ourselves, to find each other, to find a filter, a paradigm of which we can interact with each other and have the most pleasant experience. Our children, our spouses, our neighbors, people on the internet. Hopefully this episode helps. Hopefully you feel me in this one. I know this episode kind of wandered around a little bit, but I really honestly think it's valuable to look at things from all the minutiae, all the tiny little fine-tuning aspects of our thought process so that we can really dig down inside. Because once you've listened to an hour and a half of a concept versus a five-minute shortened video of, you know, here's the list of things you do to make your life better, I think that stuff is forgotten just as quickly as it's heard. Because it never really digs any roots down inside your system. And maybe the one analogy that is given in the short video doesn't make any sense to you. But going through four or five or a couple dozen iterations of it from different perspectives, you catch the fish that you need to eat to make your mind better, right? So that's sort of what I'm trying to do on these episodes that are more esoteric. Anyway, if you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please go. There's audio, video, a locked Facebook group, and a Patreon page. Again, you guys have been fantastic. We have over 300 new subscribers, so I'm sure they're in a bit of a shock now that I'm not talking about the moon, but hopefully with the previous episodes, I can keep them entertained until like-minded episodes come back up. I am planning a lot more of that content this season because I think there's a lot more to dive into. I'm having to do some research to get my next moon episode put together. So I'm going to have to go through some very specific stuff, so stay tuned. But anyway, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.